Now, I am pleased to introduce our keynote speaker today, U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan. Widely recognized as a national leader on energy and agriculture issues, Senator Dorgan was first elected to Congress in 1980 and represented his home state of North Dakota for 30 years in Washington. After retiring from the Senate 2 years ago, he became a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, where he has recently joined former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott to launch and chair the Senator's Strategic Energy Policy Initiative. As a congressman and a senator, he was a champion for biodiesel and other renewable fuels. He repeatedly authored legislation to create federal renewable fuel standards and was a strong advocate for the biodiesel tax incentive. He is highly engaged in energy policy development, and we are thrilled that he will join us today to share his insights as we lay a course for the next 20 years. Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Byron Dorgan.
Well, thank you very much, Ann. Thanks for the introduction. And let me say to all of you that Ann and her team do an extraordinary job looking after your interests and fighting for your interests. And as you might imagine, in December and early January, when the change occurred finally at long, long last, Ann and her team had a lot to do with the good news that was brought to the biofuels industry. Let me mention a couple things. Number one, I understand that someone has already said thank you for that two-minute commercial about family farming by Paul Harvey at the Super Bowl. I watched that evening, and I thought, that is so wonderful to describe those who take care of America out on the family farm. I grew up in a rural setting. My father was a great horseman. We raised horses and cattle. I learned how to pour cement, weld a seam, haul bales, grease a combine, build a lean-to. You know, the only university in America where you learn all those things is on the family farm. And the question is, what's that worth? But I also, living in rural America, graduated from high school in a senior class of 9 students. I was in the top 5. Well, you laugh. My parents were very proud. You know, in my little hometown of 300 people, we knew everybody. The 4th of July for the parade, they parked the float and had people walk around it. It was a great, great town. And from that small desk in the high school in that little town, eventually I made it to a desk in the United States Senate. Pretty improbable journey, and one of great privilege for me. And at that desk in the United States Senate, I authored the first renewable fuel standard in 2005. 8 billion gallons in the Energy Committee on which I served. I and 2 other members of the committee offered an 8 billion gallon RFS. I took it to conference with the House and compromised at 7.5 billion gallons. Thought that was a pretty good compromise. 2 years later, it became a free-for-all, and George W. Bush, as president, said that he supported a much more robust approach, 36 billion gallons. So I was involved in writing the 36 billion gallon statute as well. And here we are. Now, I thought about how did I get involved in renewable fuels? Well, my dad, in addition to the other things, hauled petroleum to farm delivery. He hauled gas and propane and diesel and so on. And during one of his travels, he said to me at age 16, Byron, there's an old Model T in a granary that's never been driven for decades. You ought to see if you could buy it from Tony Erickson. So I wrote Tony a letter. He was in Wisconsin. And I said, my dad says you have an old 1924 Model T sitting in the granary. I wonder if I could buy that from you. Tony sent me the key and the owner's manual and said, send me $25. Then I had a 1924 Model T Ford. Wouldn't run, was full of rust. All the wires were eaten off, and at age 16, I rehabbed and got that old Model T started. I didn't keep it very long because I understood you couldn't date in a Model T Ford. No girl wanted to ride a 1924 Ford. But what I understood after getting that car running again was you put gasoline in a 1924 Model T Ford the same way you put gasoline in a 2011 or 2012 car. Nothing had changed. And then I remember once asking my father about diesel, because we were hauling diesel out to a farm. I said, where does diesel come from, and how is that different from gasoline? And he said, well, look it up. So then I looked it up, and I found out about Rudolph Diesel. You all know about Rudolph Diesel, right? He showed up at the 1900 World's Fair, this engineer that had built a diesel engine, and he ran his diesel engine on peanut oil 113 years ago. Isn't that something? And I thought about that. So we haven't changed the way we fuel vehicles very much. And 100 years ago, Rudolph Diesel showed up and was running a new engine with peanut oil. There might be a way to go back to the future here and decide that we want to change our future some. And so I got involved in a very aggressive way with respect to renewable fuels as an author of the Renewable Fuels Amendment that became law. And I'm enormously proud of having done that. Now, I served in the Senate for the last 18 years and 12 years before that in the U.S. House of Representatives. I was 30 years in the Congress, and I decided I wanted not to commit the next 6 years of my life to that. I wanted to do some other things, and so I'm writing two more books, be my third and fourth book, and doing a lot of things and enjoying it a lot, but still very involved in energy. And I look back and people ask me, what do you see when you look back at Congress? Does it look as bad to you as it looks at the rest of us? And I said, well, you know, I have great respect for the men and women who serve there. I like them. They're friends of mine. And I said, it reminds me a little bit, this dispute that goes on, it reminds me a little bit of Ogden Nash's poem. He drinks because she scolds, he thinks. She scolds because he drinks, she thinks. Neither will admit what's really true. He's a drunk and she's a shrew. I don't allege that to be the nature of my colleagues, only that each believes the other side's at fault. And somehow it just doesn't work. Things have just changed so much. I was thinking about this the other day. Even the way we disagree and the language we use changes. You watch, you tune into the radio and television programs, and you hear words like liar, traitor, shameful, betray, anti-flag, anti-family, anti-American, right? You heard it all. Let me tell you a story about one day. I'm presiding over the Senate, and Bob Byrd is on the floor from West Virginia. And a senator from Pennsylvania had just finished speaking, someone I won't name, Rick Santorum. And he had just finished speaking, and he was very vitriolic and very sharp and very angry. And Bob Byrd was so upset at the words that had been used on the floor of the Senate that he felt was disrespectful. So here is the way Bob Byrd responded. This was a long while ago. And I'm thinking, it is such a much more elegant way of disagreeing. Bob Byrd stood up after my other colleague sat down. Senator Byrd said, Mr. President, I have served in this body a long, long time. Long enough to see pygmies strut like colossus. And they, like the fly in Aesop's fable, sitting on the axle of a chariot, observe, my, what dust I do raise. And then he sat down. I thought, what a wonderful way to be highly critical. What an elegant way to say, you're all wrong, you're all wet. That's a better way of doing it. We have this gridlock that captures our political system these days, and it's not good for our country. Our country doesn't do well unless we try to find the best from both rather than the worst of each. The lubrication of democracy has always been compromise. When you and I feel very differently, we decide to compromise somewhere in between. There's not much compromise anymore because it's considered a four-letter word by some. They say there are two choices. One, stand by your principles. Just stand by your principles or cave in and compromise. And so, they say, well, I'm standing by my principles. I don't intend to compromise. Democracy can't work that way. So, what's ahead? Well, I come from the northern Great Plains, you know, where Garrison Keillor holds forth, Lake Wobegon, Prairie Home Companion. He said, we were raised by people who taught us that life is an enormous struggle. And if at some moment you should feel very happy, be patient. It'll pass. He also said, by the way, sex is good, but not as good as fresh sweet corn. Just as an aside. Now, the first quote about be patient, it'll go away, well, or it'll change, that would suggest I'm not an optimist. I really am an optimist. I really believe that there are a good number of things in this country that can have all of us believe we have a better future. And I want to describe some of them to you and talk about some of the things that we can do together, those in the biofuels industry, those who are producing biodiesel, and so on. I am co-chairing a project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, trying to lay on the president's desk and the desk of every member of Congress a truly bipartisan energy plan for the future. We've had 20 CEOs of various interests from around the country as our advisory board. I and Trent Lott are the two co-chairs, and General Jim Jones and Bill Riley are also involved as co-chairs. On February 27th, we will announce at the National Press Club the results of this plan that we intend to offer, a plan that we believe could represent a bipartisan approach, could represent progress to address our country's energy future. Now, let me say, as we talk about this, we are in the middle of a lot of good news, completely transformational. We are producing more oil and gas than anyone ever expected. We produce 25% more oil in the United States now than we did in the last presidential election, just 5 years ago. I come from a state where there's a lot of oil, as you imagine. I asked the U.S. Geological Survey to do the assessment of the Bakken. They went out and did the assessment, and I, with the U.S. Geological Survey, had a press conference and announced the result. The result, they said, was in North Dakota, in the Bakken, there is up to 4.3 billion barrels of recoverable oil using today's technology. That was the largest assessment they have ever made in the history of the lower 48 states. Pretty amazing. This is a transformational good news story, oil and natural gas. In 2007, the Energy Information Agency and FERC warned that America is running out of natural gas. In 2012, they pointed out that we have 100 years worth of natural gas. Does that sound unusual and strange? It's an unbelievable amount of good news that no one could have or would have predicted. So what does all that mean, that good news? I understand there are a number of people from the oil industry in this room. Let me say to them, first of all, that I have been a big supporter of producing oil and gas. I'm the one that offered the amendment to open up the Eastern Gulf for drilling in the energy work in 2009. That bill never got enacted into law, but it got passed through the Energy Committee on a bipartisan vote. I've been strongly supportive of the additional production in the Bakken and elsewhere. So I'm a big fan of producing more here at home of every type of energy. But let me make this point. We now import about 45% of our oil, and we are still a very oil-centric economy and country. We import about 45% of our oil. And it doesn't matter how much we produce in this country, the price of oil is an international price. Last year, the American people, it was announced on the news last night, paid more for gasoline than they have ever paid before. Why is that happening at a time when we are producing more and there's less demand? The CAFE standards, more efficiency, means that, and the slower economy means that we are actually seeing reduced demand at the same time that we have higher production. So why then, when you drive up to a gas pump, are we asked to pay more? Because it's an international price. So it is not energy security to say, well, we're producing more oil, God bless us, and that's the end of the story. We don't need to do anything else. Of course we do. We need to encourage the production of oil and gas. Yes, we do. But we also need, as part of the mix and part of energy security, which equals national security, to support and to produce new technologies and new industries and to support biofuels and renewable fuels. I'm going to come to talk about biofuels in just a minute, but let me tell you what really excites me about energy. I chaired a panel in the Senate that funded all of our energy funding across the country that was public funding, and I'll tell you what excites me. What would you say if I told you that we are working on producing liquid fuel from thin air? Would you think I was drinking? No, we're working on it. How about solar energy at night? Do you think that's a little Byzantine? We're working on it. How about synthetic microbes that we put underground and they chew their way through coal seams and leave liquid fuel in their wake? Our most abundant source of resource, that underground coal, burned it, throws a lot of bad stuff into the environment. What about synthetic microbes that would eat their way through it and turn it into liquid fuel? We're working on it. I know a guy that says he's got an engine that gets, a diesel engine, by the way, that gets 100 miles per gallon. 100 miles per gallon. And he's got very strong venture capital backing in Silicon Valley. I restarted, after 15 years, algae research at one of our national laboratories because I'm a big fan of producing algae. Isn't it great if you use sunlight, water, and CO2, which we want to get rid of, and turn it into fuel, diesel fuel in this case? All of these things are happening. And I don't know which of them will represent the magic mix or the secret sauce that will represent our energy mix for tomorrow, but I know that all of them have an opportunity to change our energy future. Yes, additional production of oil and gas provides that opportunity, but so too does the issue of renewable fuels. Now, let me mention to you that the renewable fuel story is a very strong, positive success story. This must be a football game. Now, you know, I'm actually better this way. I look better this way to you. Well, let me keep going. You don't need to see me. I was going to talk about the football game, but I won't do that. The offense got started after the lights went out. There are a couple things to understand. That number one, success doesn't sell very well. Failure does. And so this is a big success story. We have gone in a very short period of time replacing 10% of our country's gasoline with ethanol. Now imagine that. We use about 140 billion gallons of gasoline a year, and we've replaced nearly 10% with ethanol. That's a big deal. We went from 100 million gallons of biodiesel in the mid-2000s, I should say, and we're now at 1.1 billion gallons. That's a big deal. That is very successful. Why is that important? Well, because, as I said earlier, this is about security for our country. The Saudis announced, I guess they didn't announce it, we found out, the Saudis earned $1 trillion last year selling oil. $1 trillion. Now, one of the things the Saudis and their fellow members of their cartel want to do, they've said they want to keep the price of oil at $80 to $100 a barrel. And they have a cartel and a lot of other countries to work with, and that's what they want to do. Doesn't matter what we do, doesn't matter how much we produce. They want to get their $1 trillion, and so they're going to manipulate prices to do that. That's precisely why we need a future with renewable fuels. Precisely why we ought to support ethanol, and we also ought to support biodiesel and support it aggressively. Now, what I'd like to do is offer a couple of lessons today, and then I want to talk about the challenge facing us with respect to biodiesel. I'm going to talk about a couple of lessons, and if I can have the first slide. Bad news travels halfway around the world before good news gets its shoes on. Let me mention one word to you. Solyndra. You know what that means? That's the hood ornament. That's the brand for all this clean energy, renewable fuels nonsense. Shame on all you people that think and talk that way. You want wind energy, solar energy, biofuels, biodiesel, renewables? Good for you. Well, but you know what? Just stay out of the way. Real men dig and drill. If you're one of these people that drinks your Chardonnay and drives your Volvo car and hangs out with the professors of the local college and wears your corduroy jacket with a patch on the sleeve and just talks forever about all this clean energy nonsense and renewables, good for you, but you don't ever amount to much. Just stay out of our way. That's the way it was for decades, right? Not true. Renewable energy, electricity, fuels, yes, biodiesel, can and will play an important role in this country's future. It is up to us, all of us, to decide this issue. Bad news travels halfway around the world before good news gets its shoes on. We're the ones that have to get good news fully dressed here. Why do you all know Solyndra? Most of what was spent in pursuit of clean energy in the Economic Recovery Act was successful and will be successful for the long term and will strengthen this country. Solyndra was a failure, and failure sells when it becomes a brand for those that want it to sell. It's our job to get good news fully dressed, especially with respect to what we have done with respect to biodiesel production. That's the first lesson. Second slide. An old Cherokee Indian chief said, "The success of a rain dance depends a lot on timing." You know what? Timing is everything, isn't it? In our lives, in our public policy. If it's going on and you're not there, if it's happening and you haven't shown up, you're in trouble. I hate to quote Woody Allen, but he said, "The world is run by those who show up." So timing in terms of public policy, the kinds of things that are going to happen, decisions that are going to be made, hearings that are going to be held, the kinds of things that are going to be dispositive in determining, will this tax incentive be continued? If so, for how long? Will the renewable fuels standard be repealed? You've got to have the timing right. You've got to get good news fully addressed, and you've got to have the timing right to make this fight and be there while the fight's going on, and in fact, be there well ahead of the fight. And finally, one more lesson, if I might. Sigmund Freud's grandson's name is Clement. He lives in England. He said this: "When you hit someone over the head with a book and get a hollow sound, it doesn't mean the book was empty." Now, what's the lesson here? The lesson is a lot of people are reluctant to be repetitive to the point of being annoying. You know, you try something, you push, and you get rejected. The answer to that is never, ever, ever quit. If your ideas have merit, just keep pushing and pumping and be relentless. It matters how relentless a group is with respect to Congress and the president to achieve public policy success. The fact that you can't sell your idea the first time or the tenth time doesn't matter. You've got to continue and continue until you make it happen. Has anybody here ever broken up a driveway, cement driveway? I have. My dad asked me to do that. And I'm going to tell you how it works. I took a 16-pound sledgehammer. I was a young guy. And my dad said, "You know, we're going to have some new cement on the driveway. We need to break this one up. Somebody's going to come in and take the pieces away," and so on. So I went out to the driveway and started pounding on the driveway. And you hit the driveway with a 16-pound sledgehammer as hard as you can hit it, and nothing visible happens. I mean nothing. You hit it again and again and again and again. And about the 15th time you hit that cement driveway, it just fractures. Just fractures and comes apart. Because all those previous hits had an impact, but you couldn't see it. Same is true in dealing with the Congress or the president in terms of public policy. So the lesson's pretty simple, it seems to me. The lessons are, you got to be there on time. You have to be relentless. You have to make certain that you have a narrative that makes some sense? The narrative for me, for biodiesel or renewable fuels, is not that we're producing a gallon of something from soybeans or canola. That's not the narrative. When they ask a bricklayer once, what are you doing? One of them said, I'm laying bricks. The other one said, I'm building a cathedral. You're not just using canola to produce a gallon of biodiesel. You're doing several things. Number one, you're providing greater energy security for this country, security we desperately need. Number two, you're helping clean up this country's environment. I mean, your product is the one that works, right? We've come to intersections now where you've got to talk about two things. One is energy policy, and the second is environmental policy. Well, you should come with a big smile, Permagrin, in fact, when you come to that intersection, when you come talking about biodiesel. This is about national security, energy security, and it's also about cleaning up our environment with a product that you produce. And then finally, after a century after we created a Homestead Act that had your ancestors and mine decide to go sit and plop themselves down on a quarter section of land so they could own the land and begin a farm, and we populated rural America that way. Now it's being hollowed out. People are leaving. You draw an egg shape from North Dakota down to Texas on both sides and take a look at rural counties, you'll see a mass exodus out of those rural counties. What do they need? They need jobs. What are you talking about, producing biodiesel? You're talking about providing energy to an economy, providing juice to an economy, providing jobs for an economy. That's what biodiesel is. It's energy security, national security, it's a better environment, and it's jobs for rural America. There is no downside. So when you have the opportunity to ask the question, you can answer it. Is energy security important to the country? If the answer is yes, then you support biodiesel. You have to, as public policy advocates. Is a cleaner environment important for our future? If the answer is yes, the answer is biodiesel. If rejuvenating the economy of rural America and providing jobs we desperately need, if that's important, if the answer is yes, the answer has to come back to biodiesel. That's the narrative. Now, let me just mention the challenges that we have. There are two, and they are huge. One is Congress understands that it has to cut some spending, it has to reform the tax code somehow, get some additional revenue in. And so the issue of the continuation of a renewable fuel standard depends a lot on tax incentives, number one, and number two, it depends on the ability and the spending and taxing choices made by Congress to support these issues. And that's not altogether certain. In fact, in December and January, when we got the good news that we were going to get an extension and so on, that wouldn't have happened, in my judgment, I'm just giving you an estimate, had the entire House of Representatives voted on it. I don't think it would have happened. It would have come through the House Ways and Means Committee. I used to serve on that committee, but I think we might well have lost that. The Senate saved the day, but this challenge still exists because much, much more needs to be done. I know they've put us on the edge of the cliff time and time again. There's about three more cliffs in front of us. But on the issue of taxing and spending, the issue of renewable fuels is at risk. There is another set of issues out in front of us, and that is the American Petroleum Institute. And I told you earlier that I support the production of oil and gas, additional production. I've been a strong supporter of that. I am profoundly disappointed at the American Petroleum Institute deciding they want to repeal the renewable fuel strategy, the renewable fuel standard. It's just flat out wrong. Just wrong. You know, they say, well, let's not pick winners and losers. And I say, I agree with you. I want to pick winners. But I'm for picking. I want this country to choose and pick winners. We said in 1916, if you go looking for oil and gas someplace in America, God bless you. We love you. We want you to continue to do that. In fact, we will give you some incentives in the tax code to keep doing it. I'm not critical of that. I say good for us. But if that's the case for 100 years, why do we decide now for technologies that are yet, that have yet to become completely mature and to grow to scale? Why do we say, well, let's shut those off? We got ours, now let's pull up the ladder. That's not the right thing for our country. It just isn't. It just isn't. So we have to fight back, and it's going to be a big fight. This is, you know, this is a pretty well-heeled opponent. But we have the facts on our side. We've got a pretty strong narrative. And I think it's very, very important that we be relentless with this success story. We're not pulling along a wagon that's heavy. You know, this is a success story. And we need to do this together. And in my judgment, I know there are some differences from time to time in the different renewable fuels areas. Look, we have to work together because we can't let them repeal a renewable fuel standard. In the old West, when they repopulated the West with wagon trains, they understood immediately. You don't move the wagon train ahead by leaving some wagons behind. You move together. And that's what we have to do if we're going to be successful in this struggle. It just seems to me that we're probably never going to score on defense. You know, if they put you in a defensive posture, you never score on defense. We've got to be much, much, much more aggressive with this success story. Again, in my little hometown, my dad took me to the blacksmith once, and we had a blacksmith there, and I watched him for a long time, and I watched what he did with, he was horseshoes and plowshares and things, and one of the things I noticed is he'd take these big tools, and he'd stick a piece of metal in this forge, and it'd get white hot, and he'd get a big hammer, and he'd pound on it. And as I thought later in life about that, you bend steel with heat, I learned that in Congress. That works in Congress. You bend steel with heat. Heat is very important to apply at the right time and the right way. So, again, we have a mission. We've had some success, thanks to Anne, her team, and all of you for all that you've done. At the end of the year, in the extender package, finally, at last, at long, long last, some of this got done. But it's temporary, short term. Is it good news? Sure it is. Absolutely. But challenges lie ahead, challenges that we have to succeed in overcoming. And that's where all of us come in to have a renewed spirit to make sure this happens. Now, I want to just mention one final thing. I read once about Thomas Edison visiting with Henry Ford and Harvey Firestone. And they were talking about energy. And Edison, who was really one smart guy, Edison said, I'd put my money on the sun. I'd put my money on the sun. Well, that's biofuels, isn't it? That's biodiesel. I'd put my money on the sun. All these decades, all these years later, we're still struggling because when Henry Ford made the Model T and the internal combustion engine became the mechanism by which we move vehicles. And so now 90% of the fuel used in vehicles is oil-based. 70% of all the oil in America is used in transportation. So that's the journey we've been on. But there's another journey that can supplement that as well and provide greater security, strength to our environment, and new jobs. And that's the security that comes understanding that renewable energy has a very strong place to play in our country's future. Now, I want to leave you with one story, if I might. There was just an inauguration in Washington, D.C., and you probably saw some of it. How many of you saw the inauguration, the parade and the inauguration on television? Let's see some hands. Yeah, quite a few of you. Well, these parades are so magnificent, you know, just really wonderful. And so it reminded me when I saw that parade about the letter I'd received from a town in North Dakota about 3 years ago now, just before I left the Congress, and I received a letter from Bowbells, North Dakota, a town of 300 people. Well, right away, it got my attention. I mean, I like towns of 300 people. It's where I grew up. And it was the high school asking whether I would nominate the high school to march in the Memorial Day parade in Washington, D.C. Well, I didn't know that you nominated, but I said, sure, of course, I'd be happy to nominate. I wrote him a note back, I'd be happy to nominate. So I nominated the Bull Bells North Dakota High School Band to march in the Memorial Day parade. You can imagine the Memorial Day parade is the parade. Memorial Day, Marine Marching Band, Air Force Marching Band, the Army Marching Band, the best college marching bands, and so on. You can imagine what that parade's like down Constitution Avenue with flags flying. I said, I'd be happy to nominate you. About a month later, I got a letter back, and the letter said, Senator Dorgan, we've approved to have the Bull Bells High School Band participate in the Memorial Day Parade. I called the high school, and they said, oh, man, this is unbelievable. We're gonna march in the Memorial Day Parade. Thank you so much, Senator. God bless you. It's terrific. About a week later, I got a call from Bull Bells, and they said, could you come by Bull Bells and so that we could play a couple tunes for you in the gymnasium before we leave for Washington, D.C., and thank you, and so on. I said, well, I'll be up in Bottineau, North Dakota. I'll be happy to stop by. It's a Friday night. I know it's not the most opportune time, about 6 o'clock or so. Would that absolutely be happy to have you then? So I pulled into Bull Bells, North Dakota, and the school parking lot was full. They'd invited the townspeople, and I was coming to see the band in the gymnasium. When I walked in, the parents were there, and they were so excited. They said, Senator Dorgan, God bless you for our band's going to Washington. We are so pleased and so excited. They said, you know, this is the first year of the marching band here at Bull Bells. I said, no, actually, I wasn't aware of that. I wasn't aware of that. They said, yeah. They said, you know, the last time we had a marching band was 29 years ago. And when the marching band stopped, they took the uniforms and put them up in the attic of the school. So we got them down. And they had those, you know, those big fur hats like in England that go way up. They said, we're able to use the entire uniform except for the bell-bottom trousers. The band came out on the gymnasium floor, and there were 29 of them. And what I discovered is that in order to get 29 kids to play in a high school band in a town of 300 people, you've got to go from sixth grade up. And so the biggest boy played the tuba, senior in high school, and the smallest girl in sixth grade played the tenor saxophone. And they marched around that gymnasium and played three tunes. And you know, it's the first year for the Bull Bells band. But anyway, I was proud of them, and they were proud of themselves. And the next time I saw them, they'd gotten on a bus, they drove to Washington, D.C., and they were marching down Constitution Avenue, 29 kids. And they had a little banner in front with two kids holding the banner. And it said, Bull Bells High School Marching Band. And I think people around the parade route just sort of knew what this was. This was the little band that could. No, they weren't the best on the parade route because they were marching behind the Marine Marching Band. They were marching behind the U.S. Army Marching Band. But these 29 kids were so proud. And they were marching down Constitution Avenue, and people were standing and applauding this little high school, Bull Bells, North Dakota. And afterwards, I told them how proud I was of them. And they were just beside themselves. It was sort of an audacious thing for a town of 300 with a marching band in its first year to decide it wants to march on Constitution Avenue. But you know, that avenue is open to anybody, not just the Bull Bells High School Marching Band. I was happy to get them there. And you don't need a letter from me for you to be there. But biodiesel and the things that we care about can also march on Constitution Avenue. And you've got actually probably more tubas and more tenor saxophones than the Bull Bells Band had. You can probably make more noise than they did. And if you decide to do that, and you must, you simply must march figuratively or literally, either one, on Constitution Avenue to Capitol Hill and to the White House to say, Here's who we are. Here's our success, and you must support us. When you do that, you need to call me, because I'd be happy to be with you to carry that banner. And when you do that, remember as well that you're connected to that sixth grade young woman that blows the tenor sax in the Bow Bells High School band, because she's a kid that wants to grow up to breathe clean air. And she wants to grow up in a country that has adequate energy supplies, diverse sources of energy, and yes, biofuels. And she's also a kid that wants the opportunity to stay at home if she can find a job at home when she graduates from school. That's what Paul Harvey was saying in that commercial. She deserves that opportunity, and she has common bond with you. You have more than 29 members. You've got a pretty big group of people across this country that believe passionately that together we can build a stronger country. Thank you very much.